developed tape where you can put little magnets on the tape, and these little magnets would have either a north pole or a south pole. And it's possible, by putting those magnets on tape, it's possible to get numbers on the tape, and you can count up as many as you want to from by using this number system on the base 2. And so I don't remember the year, but it was, I hadn't retired yet when the new math was developed and put down into the high schools, which made a great contribution to a student's education. And they were taught really the meaning of a number system, because they were taught not only number systems of base 10, that is addition, multiplication, so on, but also to handle these numbers when they were written in base 2 by using ones and zeros, or also due to another thing which I don't know too much about and is too long really to describe. But you can also, they use number systems to the base 7 for some reason. Or oh yeah, I know why. Just happened to think of it. When you want to put a number, they have little neon tubes arranged so that 7 of them is sufficient to indicate all the numbers from 1 to 9. 8, for example, would be 2 zeros put together. And like this is what they call seven segment numbers. And when these were developed, of course, then they needed a number system to the base 7. And in order to get these, I don't know why it was done, but whoever was in charge of the educational program back in those days felt that it was necessary that students should be taught in the early grades these different number systems. So they were teaching numbers, I know, numbers to the base 2, numbers to the base 7, numbers to the base 12, and as I don't think I indicated before, but 12 at one time was used as a base for counting, and the reason I know that is because we have a number which indicates 12 things. We call it dozen. We have a number which indicates 144 things, which is 12 twelves, and that is called a gross. So that the language that we use indicates to me that at one time we had a number system which counted, say, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, elf, 10, dece, doze, and dece, elf, and doze. And dozen then was 12, and then dozen 1 would be 13, and dozen 2 would be 14, and so on. And one of the faculty members here at the University of Louisville, who was in the language department, Dr. Bredarius, was one of the outstanding faculty that I liked. He and I worked together quite a lot. In fact, he taught a course in trigonometry for us back in World War II because there wasn't enough to do to teach the languages, and he needed another course, and we needed another teacher. And so he came over in the math department and taught a course in trig. He knew math pretty well. And he had developed this number system that I just quoted on the base 12, which I'm sure had its origins in astronomy. The 7, I think, also had its origins in astronomy, because way back prior to human history, the people who studied these things knew that there were 7 objects in the sky that moved differently from other objects, and I think that's where our week came from these 7 objects in the sky. And when I was teaching astronomy, these were the things that I used to enjoy teaching more than anything else, because I had run onto it in my studies of astronomy. It wasn't anything that I did myself, but I was impressed with the arguments of the book that I read, that many of the things that in everyday life, like the 7-day week and the 12-hour day and 12-hour night, which makes up a total of 24. And the number of days in a year, which is we know is 365 and a quarter, but in the early days they couldn't figure that closely, and so the year got to be thought of as being 360 days, and when people wanted to divide a circle into parts, they naturally divided the circle, which indicated the year, into parts of 360 instead of some other number. So these things interested me because I was also interested in astronomy, mm-hmm. and especially in ancient astronomy, which had a very good reason for their beliefs, contrary to what it is today, because they felt, and I can see the logic as far as they were concerned, they felt that the only way these objects could move was to have a mover. Mm-hmm. And so they invented gods to move these objects the way in which they were moved. And I'm not going to go into this because it's a long story, but one can not only see the seven-day week from the astronomy record, but you can also get the order of the days of the week from the order in which these objects move on the sky background. Saturn, for example, moved more slowly than any of the rest, then Jupiter, and then Mars, and then the Sun, and then Venus, and then Mercury, and finally the Moon, which makes up the Sun. And these objects move, of course. The Moon goes around once a month. Saturn takes a long while to go around. I don't remember. It's in the neighborhood of 30, 40, 50 years, something like that, to move across the complete sky and come back again. So if you wanted to go into the trouble, I don't want to do it here. One can show without they can show by evidence that is not historical, I'm told, but to me it's circumstantial evidence that is good enough to hang a man if you had it in court. By circumstantial evidence, you not only can get the 7 days of the week, but the order in which they occur. And that all hinges back into the seven-day week, the seven moving objects, and the fact that the hours in the day were counted by 12, and the night was counted by 12, which makes up a total of 24. And by working these numbers around, you can show how the order of the days of the week came about. Well, this is not part really of my experience at the University of Louisville, but
is that I don't know very much about astronomy. Are those ideas something that you developed yourself, or are they things?
No,
that
I found
fairly,
them in the textbook.
I see.
Oh no, I didn't develop any of it, but I was very impressed.
Yeah.
When I read it in. I don't even remember the name of the textbook anymore that I found this in, but I was so impressed with it
that
I took it on my own and used to tell my class as a part of my astronomy lectures how we got the 24-hour day, how we got the hour divided into 60, how we got the year the circle divided into 360 because of the 360 days they thought back then was the cycle of the year, and the fact that they thought of a circle as being very perfect, and that the year cycle was also perfect in that sense, and so when they wanted to divide the circle, they naturally divided it into the order, into the same number that the year was divided. Of course, that changed. Even back in the Egyptian history, they knew the year to being 365 and a quarter days. That by that time, they were important enough in the records, so they were able to do it. This is the experience that I've had in teaching astronomy, which is quite different from what my colleagues do to the present time, because now Dr. Kilcoff is much more interested in the technical side of astronomy and he gears his courses to that kind of thing, yeah, which is also important.
Sure.
And Dr. Gwynn, who is teaching the elementary astronomy, has never gone in too far into the ancient history of astronomy and math, incidentally, which I did because of my contacts in the early days with these courses in natural science and the courses in the history of science. That's how I got interested in all of this. And I was interested enough so that in Illinois, when I went back there in the summertime, which I did quite frequently at first, I went back to Illinois for summer just listening in on astronomy and listening in on some of the math that I didn't know anything about. And they were very glad to let me do that because they knew what I was interested in and very graciously let me use the classes, visit with them, because I didn't want to get any credit. I didn't want to get any more. I already had my doctorate degree, and I felt that was enough as far as credits were concerned. So I wasn't interested in credits. I was interested in the information I was getting from the professors who were teaching these courses.
Sure.
Actually, in the University of Illinois, when I got my doctorate degree, my minor was in physics rather than astronomy. At that time, as I told you in a former tape, my interest in astronomy was not as great as it was when I needed a course to keep me from teaching part-time.
Let me ask you one or two other questions about your early days at U of L that were suggested by some of the things you just said. One has to do with some of your first impressions of the university, and I know that in the years just before you came here, now it wasn't going on when you came, but in the years just before you came here, U of L had gone through quite a tumultuous
period.
And I just wondered if I know that the people who were here at the time that was going on were afraid that would give the school a bad image and that they would have difficulty attracting faculty members. And I just wondered what sort of image, if any, you had of the university based on the controversy that surrounded
it. I didn't have any because, quite frankly, the one man who was most active against Mr. Caldwell left the university before I came here and went up to Chicago and taught there. I don't remember his name anymore, but you probably know it, or you can find it in the records easily enough.
Scott Chalk.
But the people who were really concerned with the Caldwell scheme, by the time that Dr. Kemp came, and he came, by the way, the same year that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Kent was a very, very good influence for that sort of thing because I don't think he let it bother him too much.
Mm.
And he was able to get the faculty into the mood so that very little was talked about in my recollection of the troubles under Caldwell. And I don't really know, unless I wanted to go and look it up, which I never have tried, I don't really know what those troubles really were.
Yeah.
I understand they were pretty hoary, but nevertheless, by the time I came in 1929, under President Kent, who had a very, very excellent personality, by the way, and he was the only president that invited me out to dinner at his house. The other presidents didn't take that much trouble to know the faculty too well. But Dr. Kemp not only invited me, of course, but invited almost all of the faculty out to his home.
Mm-hmm.
And he had them out for a dinner. And in that way, we could get acquainted on a personal basis.
Mm-hmm.
and Kent, I think, took more interest personally in the individual faculty members than any president that has followed him. The other presidents, and this is very good, I'm not criticizing, the other presidents were more interested in the overall outlook of the university, especially the last one, Dr. Miller, who didn't have much to do with the individual faculty members, as far as I know. I didn't serve under Miller as a faculty member. I was in the Department of Physics doing this work in the physics shops, following a hobby that I had. And so I didn't really know Dr. Miller very well at all, so I refused to comment on him.
Did you ever meet him at all? Ever talk to him?
Not personally, no. Yeah. I met him, he gave a lecture in the physics colloquium one time on the work that he was very much interested in this science. What do they call it?
Systems.
Huh?
Systems science.
Yeah, systems science. That was one of his babies.
Yeah.
I understand that the former dean of the graduate school is now head of that system science.
Yeah.
And John Dillon. And so Miller and I never had any conversation at all. Uh-huh. I mean, I didn't meet him, and he didn't know me, I don't think. I'm pretty sure he didn't know me, and he wouldn't, because I'd already retired under Davidson, and the presidents that followed Davidson I didn't have any contact with. Of course, I knew Woody Strickler because I was here in the days when Woody was just an instructor in the economics department, and Woody much liked to do the work and administrative work, and so he very rapidly became head of the summer school, and then he became head of the evening college, the Division of Adult Education, I think, was developed under Woodrow Strickler, and I had quite a bit of contact with him in addition to in the math courses that were developed for night school work. I taught in the adult division, and that was part of the thing. I liked Woody very much. He was very good. I liked Davidson very much because I had quite a few conferences with Davidson. One of them that when you talk about good times and bad times, I had one conference with Davidson and Woody. Woody was the vice president and Davidson was the president. When the new wrinkle was put in for giving special compensation for, I can't remember the exact title, something on former service benefits.
Prior service benefits?
Yeah.
Prior.
Well, when that was first put in, they limited the service benefits only to those who retired after 1967. And it just happened that I retired in 1967, just a few months before they put this in. And I didn't know it for about 2 years. I was very content with what I was getting as a retirement income, which I'd helped to contribute, of course, and really deserved. But 2 years later, I don't remember the circumstance, but I had found out that they were giving this retirement benefit, which is fairly excessive. Quite a good one, and I went to Davidson and Strickler and told them what I thought about it, for doing this for part of the retirees and not for all of them. I felt that whatever they should have done should have been done for all. Mm-hmm. And I got so excited that when I left, they interviewed and started over towards my office. I began to get dizzy. And going up the stairs to the building over there, I fell once going up the stairs and picked myself up and started up. And Woody and Davidson took out after me then and came over to the office and insisted on sending me down to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And they knew that I hadn't been drinking. They took that much interest in me to see what was wrong when I was stumbling all over the place like a drunken man. And that was when I first found out that I shouldn't eat salt in great quantities. And when they put me down in the hospital, I found out that I, at that time, was the subject of what is known as Meniere's syndrome. And Davidson and Woody took care of me that evening because I was real sick. Mm-hmm. But I got so excited talking to them about this other program, mm-hmm. and that affected it. Mm-hmm. So that at least Davidson was very good that way. I mean, he was concerned with the faculty as well as concerned with the university as a whole. Mm-hmm. And as you well know, it was under Strickler and Davidson that we went into the state system. Mm-hmm. It is rather interesting, and I don't know whether it's ever been pointed out or not, that during Kent's regime, Kent, the university at that time, as I understand it, was a city institution, mm-hmm. public institution. And as such, those of us who were on the university staff did not have to pay a federal income tax. That was the beginning of the income tax thing. All the private incomes were taxed, but not income of public employees, which we were at that time. Well, it also happened, as you can easily verify, going back to the records, that public officials were limited in the salary that they could get. Mm-hmm. And so, Dr. Kent, I think it was very natural, he got the university changed from a city institution to a private institution, and then he could get a larger salary. But as soon as we went into the private status, then all of the faculty had to pay a federal income tax. That happened, I don't remember what year, but it was fairly soon after 1929 that all this happened. I think I was here about 3 years or something like that without paying the income tax. And then finally, when Dr. Kent got his raise, which was rather substantial, and I didn't blame him a bit for doing it, when the university became a private institution, although supported by about a third of the city, but it wasn't completely under the city at that time. This is one of the things that comes up that I think is never mentioned much as far as that is concerned. You commented also something about the general campus tranquility, and as I indicated, under Kent, the troubles that had previously plagued the university were over as far as that was concerned, the kind of thing that, which I don't know anything about, the kind of thing that Caldwell stirred up. I'm not at all familiar with that. I didn't go into it. I didn't want to know about it at that time. And of course, I've had no occasion to look it up since. Uh-huh. And I'm sure it was well-founded, but I don't know anything about it. But under Kent, the university went along, as I can understand it, under a pretty tranquil basis. And none of us on the faculty, as far as I know, there wasn't any complaint when we had finally to pay an income tax in order that President Kent could get a salary, which is, at that time, comparable for the kind of work that he was doing. Mm-hmm. He was worth what he was paid, I'm quite sure. Mm-hmm. Another thing that you won't find in the history has to do with a very minor element of the university life, and that is the commencement exercises. Dr. Stevenson was ahead of the graduate school. I think he was acting dean, not dean. And during commencement, he was the one that led the commencement program.
Uh-huh.
I understand you've got an official now that does that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Dr. Steve led the program, and of course, me being in the department and acquainted with him, I was one of the two who led the faculty.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Stevens was the head, and then I was head of one line, and Dave Lawrence was head of one line at one time. I don't remember who was head at first, but anyway, we two lined up the faculty by schools and took care of that. So I, for many years, I used to be the third in command.
Were there any memorable incidents associated with that?
What's that?
Were there any memorable incidents associated with
only one I remember when one of the mayors of the city of Louisville came out. And he was a fellow that I had talked with. I don't remember his name now anymore. I'm sorry, I should remember it, but I don't. But anyway, when he came up into the line, I commented to him. I said, "I can tell you where you should go." And he looked at me kind of funny. And I put him into the line. And we both had a good laugh about that. And then also one amusing thing, Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Davidson giving out the certificates to students. But when we had people who had honorary degrees, they not only gave out these citations for the degree, but they also had special hoods.
Mm-hmm.
And I had for several years, I was the one that put the hood over these visiting dignitaries.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that little bit of thing very minor, of course, but they called me the hooder, hood carrier, that was it, hood carrier, which I was, of course. But if you happen to know a brick terminology,
yeah,
the hod carrier is the fellow that handles the brick.
Yeah.
So I was the hood carrier for many years because of Dr. Stevenson's role in heading the whole thing. Then we had a registrar then, Mr.
Houchins?
Houchins. When he took over the registrar's office, then he took over this function of reading him, and in the meantime, Dr. Stevenson had died, and I was kept on as the leader, and I, as long as I was here as faculty member, I helped in leading the faculty at commencement, which is part of one of my duties that I had.
What have been some of the the high points and changes that you've seen in the university? Can you mark the Depression as a time of change? Can you mark World War II, state affiliation, those sort of things?
One of the changes that affected me, and it was a very natural one, here at the university in the math department, we had a feeling, both Dr. Stevenson and myself, that a student should take analytic geometry before he took calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And so every student that wanted to get calculus, which is the useful part of mathematics, had to take a course in analytic geometry, which I taught.
Mm-hmm.
Geometry was my main interest in life, and so I taught the geometry courses.